From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Sergeant-at-Arms, will you escort His Excellency the Governor to the platform?
Do we still call New York Governors His Excellency? Sounds like a title more fitting for Archduke Ferdinand than Governor Nelson Rockefeller, but that's how they introduced the man known as Rocky way before Sylvester Stallone was, as he prepared to take the oath of office and give his inaugural address on New Year's Day, 1963. And with that, we begin our live special coverage of Elliot Spitzer's inaugural address. I'm Brian Lehrer in New York with WNYC's Elaine Rivera at the inauguration in Albany. We'll go live to Elaine later. The Spitzer speech will be around 1 o'clock, but let's begin with some history. Thanks to WNYC archivist Andy Lancet, we have excerpts of the inaugural addresses by Rockefeller in 63, Cuomo in 83, and Pataki in 95. And let's dive right into some vintage Rocky as he begins his address by tying the Civil War to the Cold War.
Very reverend clergy, your honorable bodies, and ladies and gentlemen, this is an historic occasion, an anniversary. Just 100 years ago, on January 1st, 1863, the Emancipation Proclamation became law, and human slavery was abolished in our land. In the immortal words of Abraham Lincoln, all Americans were henceforth and forever free. This great document of human liberty was promulgated at a time when the cause of union and of freedom itself was in perilous trial. But its very pronouncement then served notice of the strength and courage of free men, and their determination that human justice and equality should prevail. We are met at a time when freedom is again on trial, when our very way of life is challenged, not only through military aggression, but in the marketplace, in the factories, on the farms, in the laboratories of science, and in the schools. This is an all-encompassing struggle, a competition for the minds and hearts of men, in which human dignity, freedom, and equal opportunity are the stakes.
Governor Nelson Rockefeller from his inaugural address in 1963. We will hear more in a minute, and we are delighted to have with us on this New Year's morning an all-star lineup to provide historical context. Peter Eisenstadt, managing editor of the Encyclopedia of New York City and editor-in-chief of the Encyclopedia of New York State. Henry Stern, New York City Parks Commissioner in the Koch and Giuliani administrations, now a blogger and director of a think tank and watchdog group called New York Civic, and a walking encyclopedia of New York City and New York State himself. And Esther Fuchs, Columbia University political science professor who returned to academia last year after taking a leave of absence to be a key policy advisor to Mayor Bloomberg in his first term. Henry Stern, Peter Eisenstadt, Esther Fuchs, thanks so much for doing this. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Brian.
Happy New Year.
Esther, Nelson Rockefeller's speech, which we'll hear more of in a minute, was not much about specific policies of state government like we expect to hear from Spitzer today, like property taxes or Medicaid or whatever. Today we get these laundry lists, but a lofty statement of ideals rooted in the Cold War. What's your reaction to that clip we heard or its context?
Well, I think Rockefeller always saw himself as a big idea person, and we know he always wanted to be president of the United States. So it's interesting because he didn't really talk about the details of his plan, but he certainly did more than most of our governors who spoke beautifully. He built, really, roads and highways and a state university system, and he actually was an amazing caretaker of the environment. I think the legacy of the Rockefeller drug laws have been very difficult and problematic for New York, but he was a hugely successful governor in many ways without creating the laundry list. He just never got to be president of the United States, which is what he really wanted.
Of course, he got to be vice president, yes, thanks to Gerald Ford, who everybody's been talking about the last few days, obviously. Peter Eisenstadt will play some more of this Rockefeller inaugural, but do you want to say something about the context in which Rockefeller took office as governor of New York?
Well, you know, it's important to remember, Brian, that this was not his first term. He was elected in 1958, and this was his second inaugural. And I think Rockefeller was already a pretty well-known commodity to New Yorkers, and I think he was responding to, in part, the civil rights crisis that was, you know, raging in early 1963.
So the civil rights crisis as well as the Cold War in that clip. And by the way, Henry Stern, do they call governors Your Excellency anymore, as they did in introducing that speech?
Well, I know that they used to, and it was in these little books which contained forms of address, which they used to circulate. I don't know what the current practice is, but I doubt it.
Well, maybe we'll find out in a little while. It sounds anachronistic to me. Let's listen to two more clips from Nelson Rockefeller's 1963 inaugural address, in which he talks about what he considers the two pillars of the success of American society. And as we go here, we will hear him talk about liberalism, conservatism, progressivism, the perfectibility of man. But here's the first one.
The continuing success of our American system, in my opinion, has rested chiefly on two interdependent factors which have given it a unique character. The first of these is the concept that freedom is opportunity. Compared to other societies, ours is an open society to a very high degree. Opportunity for education and career advancement are ever more widely available. The individual man and woman enjoy a degree of human dignity unequaled in other parts of the world. The social mobility possible in America is still unprecedented, extending to the dignity of those who labor, giving the working man a self-respect greater than in any other part of the world. Admittedly, however, there are imperfections which must be removed. We must strive ever more ceaselessly to extend these opportunities and this dignity to every member of all groups of our society, no matter what their race, color, religion, origin, or status. Only in this way can we attain the fullest, full accomplishment of the American idea.
Again, Rockefeller, clearly in the context of the civil rights movement. If that was January 1st, 1963, well, that was the same year in which Martin Luther King would deliver his I Have a Dream speech later in the summer in Washington. And we're going to continue right where that left off. And folks, listen carefully here for Rockefeller's use of the terms liberal, conservative, and progressive. And believe it or not, his reference to the perfectibility of human beings.
There is a second factor, however, that has made for the flexibility and the greatness of our American system. We Americans are so accustomed to talking about individual rights that sometimes we overlook the other basic concept. It is that we in America view freedom as responsibility. This responsibility begins, of course, at the level of the individual citizen. It requires an emphasis on self-reliance and on the dignity of work. It includes his duty to respect the rights of others. It extends as well to those obligations of his which have to do with civic participation. It is the duty of every citizen not only to cast his ballot, but to cast it wisely as he can. And this is not always easy. There is a danger that the voter may mistake words for substance, superficial panaceas for basic solutions, and be deluded by slogans and labels such as conservative, liberal, and progressive. Life cannot be oversimplified, made all black or all white. Conservative, liberal, progressive are not mutually exclusive concepts. They are important elements of basic values in all three. We should respect conservatism because we know the measureless value that is our heritage to save, to cherish, and to enrich, because we believe that everything that is soundly built for the future is built in the present on the foundations of the past. We should respect liberalism because we should be more concerned with the opportunities of tomorrow than in the record of the past. Because out of the past and the present, a better future can and must evolve. And we should respect a progressive point of view because the opportunities and the challenges facing us now and in the future are of such size and scope that we can never halt and say our labor is done. Because we believe in stable, ordered change and human progress, in the perfectibility of the individual human being and of human society.
Wow. That again from Nelson Rockefeller's 1963 inaugural address, taking office as governor of New York for his second term, as we warm up for Eliot Spitzer's inaugural address for his first term today. The Albany weather, by the way, has caused a one-hour delay in the original schedule, so the inaugural will be at 1 o'clock, not 12 o'clock as was originally set, and we will be here back for that, actually, live at 1 o'clock following an hour of the Leonard Lopate Show at noon. But my guests right now for this journey through New York State history are Peter Eisenstadt, editor of the Encyclopedia of New York City and New York State, Columbia professor and former Bloomberg advisor Esther Fuchs, and Henry Stern of New York Civic. And Esther, talk about a modernist idea, the perfectibility of the individual human being. Never mind the history of New York State. What a different time in the history of the American mind.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I listened to that almost dumbfounded because, I mean, he sounded almost like Isaiah Berlin in his concept of, you know, positive and negative freedom and asking people to be both responsible in their exercise of their freedom and not to expect everything from government. It was an extraordinary balance, and it just reminds you of a different time in political discourse. And, you know, it's not that there wasn't people using everything to attack you negatively, but certainly Rockefeller in this speech thought he could control the definitions of terms, the meaning of language, so that you could actually create a positive spin for being a liberal or a conservative. That would be impossible to do today, given what's happened with the dominance of political advertising and the role of people like Lee Atwater and Karl Rove in really destroying that kind of political discourse.
Well, as we proceed this hour, we will hear Cuomo embrace liberalism, though he doesn't really use the word. He talks about progressive pragmatism.
That's right. He already changed. By Cuomo's period, you're not really associating yourself with the word liberal anymore in too many public places.
Right. And of course, we will hear a very conservative speech or some excerpts from it by George Pataki. But Henry Stern, was that very Nelson Rockefeller of him to talk like that about liberalism, conservatism, and progressivism and kind of embrace all three?
Well, it was something. I can tell you, first let me just say that Nelson Rockefeller reminds me to some extent of Michael Bloomberg in the sense of an outsider coming in with a great deal of money, starting at the top, and doing a good job. As far as the speech goes, I don't take it too seriously because Persico, who was the writer of many of his books, said publicly, Nelson Rockefeller never even read the books he wrote.
So you think that had to do with, you think that applied to the inaugural address as well?
I think it's purely.
He did it really effectively, don't you think?
Yes, he delivered the lines well, and reminds me of a story of justices of the Supreme Court. The opinions are prepared by law assistants, and then they're given to the judge to sign, and afterwards their names, it says JSC for Justice of the Supreme Court, but in the courthouse they say it means just sign carefully.
Well, you know, I've seen a copy of the Spitzer inaugural address, which I'm not allowed to talk about on the air because it's embargoed until it's delivered, but I can say that I think we're going to hear some of this same attempt, which maybe comes back after a 44-year cycle, to talk about going beyond political labels and partisanship, and we'll see what everybody thinks once Spitzer delivers it today, and then of course we'll see how he governs. But Peter Eisenstadt, it sounded like we use the word progressive differently today than Rockefeller used it there. I think it's more a synonym for liberal now, whereas Rockefeller referred to it as a distinct political philosophy. Did you notice that?
Yes. Well, it had the very interesting term, history progressive, obviously. In the 40s, it became a synonym for communist to some extent, or close to communist with the Progressive Party. And it sort of lost that meaning in the 50s. I think, he was in 63 thinking of very much running for president. And with the Goldwater Challenge, there, and I think he was trying to position himself as being above labels, as being both liberal, conservative, and progressive at the same time.
So I guess he really was a Rockefeller Republican.
Yeah, it's very interesting to think that so-called, post-war liberalism in New York State was basically under Republicans, under Thomas Dewey and Rockefeller, with 4 years of Democrat April Harriman from 1954 to 58, but almost all the period that people think of as post-war liberalism was under Republican governors.
Hmm. And did you have any reaction? I just have to come back to this for 1 second before we go on to Mario Cuomo, to that line about the perfectibility of the individual human being. I mean, that left me flabbergasted when I heard that when I was screening the speech on Friday. Maybe psychologists from Once Upon a Time like Maslow talked about that. Nobody thinks that there's a perfectibility possible in human nature today. I can't believe he was talking like that in 1963.
Well, I think that, social engineering, the belief that American society could get better and better with, I think, a cardinal belief of liberalism until, I think, the late 60s, when I think a lot of these, a lot of these things changed.
Right.
But I think it was a key belief that American society could get better and better and towards a perfectible future.
Henry?
Well, I think it's maybe more defined on personal terms. Those were difficult times for Rockefeller. First, there was the Murphy divorce, which at the time was considered a great blow to his chances for the presidency. No longer. Both McCain and Giuliani and Ronald Reagan have all been divorced, and that stigma has passed. And then his son drowned in the South Pacific, and he went out to search for a month. It was traumatic, and I don't know how much serious attention he gave to that phrase.
Yeah, well, the search for the perfectibility of humankind arguably led to some of the great horrors of the 20th century, but there was still that belief in Kennedy-esque progress at that time, at the beginning of 1963, by the end of which Kennedy would be assassinated. When we continue in a minute, we move to the Mario Cuomo era. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live coverage of the Elliott Spitzer inaugural address. Brian Lehrer on WNYC on New Year's morning. Happy New Year, everyone. It's live special coverage of Elliott Spitzer's inaugural address, part one, as we listen to clips of Governors Rockefeller, Cuomo, and Pataki in their inaugural addresses. Next clip, next era, it's New Year's Day, 1983, when Governor Mario Cuomo has just been sworn in. Ronald Reagan, remember, is president, and listen to Cuomo go after him.
We will not allow the national administration to escape responsibility for its policies. We will continue to point out what we believe respectfully is a massive inequity of the new redistribution of national wealth, a redistribution that moves our nation's resources from the vulnerable Northeast and Midwest to the affluent or at least less troubled parts of the nation. We will point out what we believe is the cruelty and economic recklessness of the unemployment that these policies produce, and the mistake. And we will point out what we believe is the mistake of an excessive multiplication of nuclear weapons that denies us the resources we need.
Mario Cuomo calling Ronald Reagan cruel and reckless. My guests, Peter Eisenstadt, managing editor of the Encyclopedia of New York City and editor-in-chief of the Encyclopedia of New York State, Henry Stern, New York City Parks Commissioner in the Koch and Giuliani administrations, now director of the think tank New York Civic, and Esther Fuchs, Columbia University political science professor and former policy advisor to Mayor Bloomberg. And Peter Eisenstadt, talk about the context. I mean, we're still a nation in the Cold War at that point in 83, but it sounds like we were also more in the partisan culture wars than when Rockefeller took office in 1963.
If I may for a second, I think maybe a moment we should mention Hugh Carey.
Who came in between Rockefeller and Cuomo and served for one term.
He was elected first in 74 for two terms. And he gave, either in his inaugural or in his first State of the State message, what maybe is the most memorable statement that any governor has made when coming into office, when he said, "The days of wine and roses are over," and dealing with the...
And again, recalling Gerald Ford, Ford to City, drop dead, all of that, that was the moment of the New York City fiscal crisis.
Right, absolutely. And I think it was the Carey administration where there was really a profound change from Rockefeller. And I just wanted to mention that before we go on to Cuomo.
Henry Stern, you want to elaborate on that? Because we don't have any Carey tape, but we shouldn't ignore him.
Well, Hugh Carey was a very fine governor, and he happens to be still alive. And we should, I'm sorry there wasn't a tape, but to go to the Cuomo speech, you know, after Cuomo's ringing words, there was an election the next year in 1984. And Ronald Reagan carried 49 states. The only state he did not carry was Minnesota, which is where Mondale was from.
The vice presidential candidate.
Yes. At that time. He was president, running for president. Mondale.
Oh, he was, of course, the sitting vice president.
Yeah.
Under Carter.
Reagan beat Carter the first time, and then he beat Mondale the second time around, overwhelmingly. So when Cuomo assumes the mantle of the poor and the troubled and the victims and the Northeast and all the rest of it, that vision did not extend past the Hudson.
I guess not. Esther Fuchs, on that, how did we get from the belt tightening of the fiscal crisis of the mid-70s and the Carey administration to Mario Cuomo invoking expansive government what seems like so quickly, and you know, after being elected in 1982.
Yeah, I want to just go back to Carey for a second also to remind everybody. I think he really is an unsung hero, and he was, I think, the single individual most responsible for making sure New York City didn't go bankrupt in 75 and really bringing the banks and the unions and the federal government to the table to create, you know, negotiate a solution for the city's problem, to restructure the debt and really figure out a way to dig the city out of the hole. And he is, I think people give credit, you know, to people like Felix Rohatyn and to the leadership of the union, Victor Gottbaum, but I think you really have to understand that Carey was the one who really put the deal together. And the fact that Mario Cuomo could come in 1983 and talk about issues that really sounded like Franklin Roosevelt was just really a reflection of his gift as an orator. And I don't think it had very much to do with the reality of what was on the ground, either in New York City or in New York State at that point, or certainly in the federal government. By 1983, we are a declining state. We are a declining city in terms of the economy. He is fighting the culture wars, as was mentioned, and really the good fight on the death penalty and abortion rights. But I don't think he understood the depth of the economic problems facing the city at that point and the direction of the trend, really.
So let's listen to a little bit more of the oratory, more Cuomo from his 1983 first inaugural, and listen in this clip to how, so different from today's political context, he invokes Darwin in the name of political conservatism and Pope John Paul in the name of the liberal.
Of course, we should have only the government we need. But we must have, and we will insist on, all the government we need. So a technically balanced budget that fails to meet the reasonable needs of the middle class and the poor would be to us the emblem of hypocrisy. It has become popular in some quarters to argue that the principal function of government is to make instruments of war and to clear obstacles from the way of the strong. It is said that the rest will happen automatically. The cream will rise to the top, whether the cream be well-endowed individuals or fortunate regions of the nation. Survival of the fittest may be a good working description of the process of evolution, but a government of humans should elevate itself to a higher order, one which tries to fill the cruel gaps left by chance and by a wisdom that we don't fully understand. I would rather have laws written by Rabbi Hillel or by Pope John Paul than by Darwin. I would rather live in a state that has chipped into the marble face of its capital these memorable words of the great rabbi: if I am not for myself, who is for me? But if I am for myself alone, then what am I? Or the words of our great Pope: freedom and riches and strength bring responsibility. We cannot leave to the poor and disadvantaged only the crumbs from the feast. Rather, we must treat the less fortunate as guests. A society as blessed as ours should be able to find room at the table, shelter for the homeless, work for the idle, care for the elderly and infirm, and hope for the destitute.
Well, vintage Mario Cuomo proclaiming the usefulness of activists, pragmatic, progressive government. We shouldn't have any more government than we need, but we need all the government that we need. And for those of you hearing a little bit of opera in the background there, I don't think they had an opera singer providing accompaniment to Mario Cuomo at his inaugural address. I think that was just a little leakage on the tape. But Esther Fuchs, reaction to that clip?
Oh, gee, I just got chills listening to Mario Cuomo. He speaks so beautifully and so eloquently about what responsibilities we have toward each other as individuals and what the role of government should be in a compassionate society. And would that he had the resources to implement much of what he said in that speech. What's extraordinary to me about the Cuomo years is how little actually government really did and how little surplus there was. I'm not really blaming him completely. He was in a way victimized by the time period and the movement of resources out of the Northeast. But certainly if you look at his budgets, you find that wherever there was excess resources, his greatest increase in spending was on prisons. So even though he declared the decade of the child, when you look at the money went to expanding the state prison system, which of course was a work program in many instances for a lot of upstate counties that were losing their economy, you know, because of industry leaving. So, I don't know, I wish there was a way of capturing the Mario Cuomo rhetoric and converting it instantly into policy.
Huh. Henry Stern, your take on this? You were already Parks Commissioner in the Koch administration during many of these years.
Yes. First, there's no question that unlike Rockefeller, Mario Cuomo wrote his own speeches and he delivered them. Compare Rockefeller's achievements. And what this should make clear to people once and for all is that gifts of oratory are not the same as gifts of government. And very often, great oratory can conceal bad government.
Do you think he was guilty of bad government, in your opinion?
Well, I think he's a good person, and I know him, and I respect him. But I think the 12 years of Cuomo sort of match with the 12 years of Pataki, in that they were 24 years of stagnation, what they call in Russia the era of Brezhnev and so on. And Rockefeller and Carey were both movers. The next two governors really weren't. And now we'll see what the new governor is.
We'll see if Spitzer is a shaker. Peter Eisenstadt, do you want to pile on?
Well, I mean, I would second the comments of Esther Fuchs that I think one needs to look at all the governors since Carey in the context of a profound economic depression and demographic depression. New York State had a demographic catastrophe in the 1970s. New York State lost more people in the 1970s than any state did in the 20th century for a 10-year period. And New York State has not recovered. I mean, New York City has come back somewhat. I live in Rochester, and I know from this part of the state it's been in a three-decade-long depression. And as Esther Fuchs said, it's very difficult to push ahead when the economic base is continually declining.
Esther, is Eliot Spitzer a Cuomo liberal? Do you expect this kind of oratory or ideological challenge in his inaugural address later today?
Well, he's certainly not a Cuomo liberal. He's a supporter of the death penalty. So that distinguishes him immediately on those kinds of social issues.
Well, at least on that one. But in his view of government and the role that government has to play in people's lives?
I think he's going to actually sound a similar theme, which is we have to have the government we need. He's going to be more balanced because the political times have changed, and it's very difficult to talk about activist government right now. However, he will be an activist governor. I'm convinced of that. And he's going to be very careful in his rhetoric and go right down the middle so that he is not labeled in this. It's much more dangerous now when you speak because it flies back in your face in a political commercial or on a radio talk show or on the internet, and you can be easily distorted. And I think that Spitzer's very well aware of that, and that this speech is going to have to be more cautious than, even though he's going to want to fly with the rhetoric, than the Mario Cuomo type of speech.
And they did release a few little excerpts of the speech to the press that we're allowed to quote before he delivers it, and one of them has to do with people getting used to the idea that we have health care that we can't afford in New York State right now. And we're going to hear that from Eliot Spitzer at the same time, Esther, as he has promised on the campaign trail to cover quickly half the people in the state who are currently uninsured and eventually all the people in the state who are currently uninsured. So how do you put those two things together?
You know, I think he's going to be somewhat like Michael Bloomberg in that he's going to want to fix what is broken in state government. And no one's been doing that for a very, very long time. It is similar to when Bloomberg came in, came into New York City. So much of the infrastructure of government is broken. You know, the oversight mechanisms, the ability to create efficiencies, all that boring stuff that has nothing to do with the beautiful rhetoric. And I think that that's where Spitzer will see his opportunity to both try and be expansive in his approach for the needy, because he clearly has that agenda, but at the same time, being fiscally conservative and cautious and really trying to create the management efficiencies that at the state level, I don't think, when is the last time anybody's ever tried to do that at the state level?
Henry?
Well, I haven't. The other thing he'll change, which I think is most important, is the culture of corruption. I think the Pataki administration was the most corrupt since I've been an adult. Mm-hmm. I think Cuomo was much better in that regard than Pataki. He built jails, but he didn't commit crimes.
And we'll continue.
Right, absolutely right.
We'll continue in a minute with our inaugural of Eliot Spitzer pregame show. Next clips, yes, George Pataki. We'll really hear how he was coming in as the un-Cuomo, and then we'll talk more about his legacy and where he leaves Governor Spitzer. Stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Happy New Year. It is live special coverage of Eliot Spitzer's inaugural address part one, as we listen to clips of Governors Rockefeller, Cuomo, and Pataki in their inaugural addresses. And then we were going to have the Spitzer speech at 12, but because of inclement weather in Albany, and I think that's redundant to say inclement weather and Albany, they will move the speech back, and we'll have an hour of the Leonard Lopate Show at noon, hooray, and then the Spitzer speech at 1 o'clock. But my guests, as we traipse through 44 years of New York gubernatorial inaugural history, are Peter Eisenstadt, managing editor of the Encyclopedia of New York City and editor-in-chief of the Encyclopedia of New York State, Henry Stern, New York City Parks Commissioner in the Koch and Giuliani administrations, now director of the think tank New York Civic, and Esther Fuchs, Columbia University political science professor and former policy advisor to Mayor Bloomberg. Next clip, next era, New Year's Day, 1995. It's George Pataki's turn, and as I said before the break, he is every bit the un-Cuomo.
Now, in mentioning the people's business, I also think it fitting that to mention today the people's mood. There is impatience, frustration, even for many anger. To those who see this as public attitude as disappointing or dangerous, I would point out that just such a mood was at the heart of the American experiment in self-government and personal liberty. Discontent with punitive taxation and the excessive bureaucracy of an oppressive government was exactly the emotion that put the spark to our own revolution and the democratic way of life it gave us. The battle, which took place on a farm not far from here near Saratoga, was the turning point in that revolution. And I would remind those who are disturbed by the people's current mood of the lesson from that battle, the lesson that much good can come from the people's determination to see that government remains their servant and not their master.
So we have moved from Rockefeller's lofty and abstract embrace of liberalism, conservatism, and progressivism to Mario Cuomo's fiery government is good rhetoric to Pataki's bland but fierce denunciation. And if you think that was all he did to denounce government, he went on and on and on. Let's listen to one more minute of this, and then we'll talk about the anger that he referenced. I don't remember hearing much about anger in any other inaugural address, so we'll talk about that, and just how anti-government Pataki entered as.
This tendency of government, with sometimes the best of intentions, to grow bigger and more powerful, has always posed history's most serious obstacle to social progress and its greatest threat to personal freedom. When government accepts responsibility for people, then people no longer take responsibility for themselves. Individual responsibility and personal freedom are inevitably linked. Limited government, then, was not just a slogan for the American founders. It was the path to greatness and the beginning of political wisdom. Let us resolve now that in the months and weeks ahead, we will return to such wisdom. We will begin where the people want us to begin, reducing the size and cost of government and getting rid of unnecessary and counterproductive programs.
So, Peter Eisenstadt, give us some context for the Pataki speech. I talked about the anger that he referred to, the public anger, as he called it in the first clip, and said not to be afraid of it, that this was, you know, hearkening back to the revolution. It was the same election as the Gingrich sweep nationally in 94. Was the context in New York State the same, what some people at the time called the angry white male?
Well, I was going to mention that. This was the same year as the Contract of America and Gingrich, and of course it's really interesting when you think about it that Pataki's year encompassed the 12 years that Republicans controlled Congress. You know, an era which is ending, I think, right now, obviously, when Spitzer takes government. You know, D'Amato, who, you know, was really the first conservative, statewide Republican conservative elected in New York in almost half a century, and who was, you know, the father, you know, the person who helped Pataki get his position, I think ushered in a new conservative strain. And I think Pataki has been a faithful reflection of, I think, standard conservative Republican language over the past 12 years.
Esther Fuchs, anything on that?
Yeah, I think it's not just that this was the period of the Gingrich revolution and the Contract for America, but it's really on the heels of after eight years of Ronald Reagan disparaging and attacking the role of government. It's become standard political rhetoric to run against government, to say government was the problem. And that has been a really destructive trend. And for a guy, I should say a governor, who ran against government and said he was going to reduce the size of government, what did he do? Increase the budget from $62 billion to $114 billion in his 12-year period. He did nothing of the kind. And so this is really a reflection of, you know, the dishonest rhetoric that comes from going after and attacking government. If you are the governor or if you are any elected official, you can't in good faith go after government. You can say you want to fix government, you want to go after, you know, ethics violations or corruption, but to say that government is the problem doesn't leave you too many opportunities to do very much that is constructive.
Yeah, I agree with Esther, who said it very well with the budget jumps. Pataki no more took the state to the right than Cuomo took it to the left. In each case, their rhetoric was ideological, but their performance was much limited and governed, of course, by budget realities. So it's like red meat.
But we do hear, and we'll play one more clip of Pataki, some very specific promises couched in these complaints about government from Pataki in his inaugural. And then I want to press you a little bit on this Pataki legacy and see if maybe he didn't accomplish some of the things that he set out to accomplish, at least at the beginning of his term. Again, very specific policy items, unlike, I believe, the governors who came before. So in addition to cutting taxes, which we've talked about, and restoring the death penalty, which we've talked about, there is the third pillar of his inaugural moment, and here it is.
Crime is a serious concern for all New Yorkers, but far too many New Yorkers are also faced the trap of a failed welfare system. Sadly, today, 1 in 11 New Yorkers is on welfare. The welfare system, though well-meaning, has failed. It's time for workfare.
So Henry Stern, Governor Pataki, has been taking, somebody's laughing there, and I guess that's
laughing.
Esther. Okay, so Esther, he's been taking a good drubbing in the press in recent weeks, but he did do the things he set out to do. He was part of the end of the welfare as we knew it movement, the crackdown on crime movement, and the lower income tax movement. All three things happened, and arguably New York and most New Yorkers, with the exception maybe of the upstate economy, are in better shape in general than they were in 1994. What do you think?
Well, it's a question of who you give that credit to and the role of New York City and the New York City mayors in that transformation. I give Pataki credit for two things, Family Health Plus and Child Health Plus, which are extraordinary, wonderful pieces of legislation.
The health insurance expansions of Medicaid.
And for protecting the environment, in a sense, expanding the parklands upstate. Those are two enormous achievements, so I'm not here to say, you know, he had a failed governorship. However, to take credit for the decline in crime, which is predominantly New York City, I think you have to go, you know, Dinkins, Giuliani, Bloomberg. That's where that comes from, and I don't see any policy emanating from the state that impacted the decline of crime. I mean, I just think that's really ridiculous.
Henry?
Yeah, I want to credit also Pataki as a parks person. He was very good on the environment, and Bernadette Castro was a good commissioner. Clinton did the welfare reform in Congress, and Giuliani implemented in New York City. Little to do with that. Crime, everyone's going to show me the politician who was stand up for crime.
Did they end parole under his? I know he campaigned on ending parole. I think that was in the inaugural address, too. Cracking down on probation and parole, some things that he said could be done at the state level. Obviously, nobody was executed despite his invoking of the death penalty.
Oh, you know, that's another thing. Esther has mentioned the death penalty twice. Is this some litmus test that anyone who is the death penalty is so scary must be a monster? Esther, how do you feel about Saddam Hussein?
Henry, I wasn't mentioning the death penalty as a litmus test. I was just pointing out that from a liberal ideological point of view, being in favor of the death penalty is not considered to be liberal.
That's so, absolutely right. So you were correct on that.
And I'm opposed to the death penalty. I've always been opposed to the death penalty personally, and I'm, you know, delighted to have that debate with you at another show.
I think at another time.
Execution
but
Saddam Hussein doesn't seem like a good case for the death penalty, just reading the paper the last couple of days.
In fact, let me promote a call-in that we're going to have on tomorrow morning show, which is going to be built around...
Love you, Henry Stern.
You're right.
Built around the following question. If pardoning Richard Nixon was good for national reconciliation, as we've heard countless times over the last few days, then what was the hanging of Saddam Hussein?
Right.
So we will talk about that more on tomorrow morning's Brian Lehrer Show beginning at 10 o'clock. Hopefully many of you who are off for New Year's will be able to listen tomorrow morning at 10 when we talk about that. But back to the legacy of George Pataki. Henry, liberals never liked Pataki for redistributing wealth to the wealthy, being obsessed with the death penalty, and having no social or economic justice agenda. And conservatives feel horribly betrayed by his borrowing and spending in later years. You're not putting any better spin on it than that, are you?
No, it's unfair to Pataki. I mean, all these people have some, and it's the same about Cuomo. They all have good qualities and bad qualities. When they get the opportunity to be on radio, some of us vent. But Pataki was really weakest on the corruption issue, and no structural change in the budget. I would say conservatives have more reason to be disappointed with Pataki than liberals, because liberals never expected anything. They lost the election.
Mm. Peter, you rooted yourself in Rochester before, where you live. Do you want to talk about a transformation of the populace over the last 12 years in Rochester? Have people who tended to put their faith in Republicans given up on the Republican Party? We certainly saw it in the election of Eliot Spitzer, and perhaps we've seen it in part of New York going Democrat for Congress when they didn't in recent elections. What would you talk about with respect to your region?
Well, you know, that there were three very close elections in the Rochester area where the Republicans narrowly won re-election in the election last November. I think there's a sense of despair that jobs continue to decline. Rochester has lost like 30,000-40,000 people since 1990. It's not just Rochester. I think it's the whole, you know, region west of Albany and Schenectady that I think people are desperate for solutions. And I don't know if the governor can provide this. Every governor talks a good, you know, strategy about attracting jobs and lowering taxes. But I think it's a pretty desperate situation.
And Esther, what did he spend all that money on, Pataki? And why wasn't that enough for the liberals to consider him, in fact, a scion of activist government?
I actually agree that he was activist. I hope I didn't represent that incorrectly, because I really pointed to his health care initiatives and his protection of the land.
Mm-hmm.
But his tax cuts really were not, you know, redistributive in a positive way. And he was fiscally irresponsible. I mean, this is a particularly important area. You have somebody who's articulating rhetoric about small government and about balancing budgets, and he, you know, we have these $3 to $4 million budget gaps every year.
Billion.
Yes, every year. He never really reined in spending. I mean, he doubled. It's like almost doubled spending, and it's hard to see exactly where the money went because the oversight was so weak. So I think that's, you know, my criticism really comes probably more from what would be considered the conservative side than the liberal side, since I do have views that are sometimes more complex than Henry Stern might suggest.
Oh, and Esther, I'm before we run,
you're very sophisticated.
I know.
I never meant to suggest that.
And before we run out of time, which we will in just a minute here, Esther, since you've been a Bloomberg top policy advisor during his first term, do you see Bloomberg and Spitzer in the same mold? And where do you see natural areas of collaboration or conflict coming down the road?
I actually think that the areas that the governor will get tremendous support from the mayor on will be the ethics and reform agenda that he's going to put into place, and this idea of reengineering and managing government better for efficiency. But there are natural conflicts between the state and the city, and, you know, we need to, you know, reinstate the commuter tax. We need reform of the welfare system in a way that doesn't kill the city, and we need reform of the Medicaid and Medicare systems. New York City is the only jurisdiction city in the country that still pays approximately 25% of the welfare costs and the health insurance costs of the needy, and that has been an extra burden on the city's economy. And I think because we are the engine here of the state economy now, it's going to be natural for Spitzer to turn around and look at the city, and I hope he doesn't do what other governors have done, which is essentially suck resources out of New York.
By the way,
last area, of course, is education and the campaign for fiscal equity, and we'll see whether Spitzer keeps his campaign promise with the level of support or he actually backtracks.
To spend $4 to $6 billion a year, and the mayor and the new governor are already sparring a little bit over whether the city is going to have to chip in to that. Peter Eisenstadt, last word, 15 seconds. As the historian, I guess, in the House, if Pataki had gotten so bad, why did all the newspaper editorial boards endorse him for a third term in 2002?
It's hard to realize, it's hard to figure out why Colin McCall did as badly as he did 4 years ago.
People didn't want change, Henry Stern, after 9/11. Big factor?
Yes.
Henry Stern, New York City Parks Commissioner in the Koch and Giuliani administrations, now director of the think tank New York Civic. Peter Eisenstadt, editor-in-chief of the Encyclopedia of New York State, managing editor of the Encyclopedia of New York City. Esther Fuchs, Columbia University political science professor. Thank you all, and again, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Brian.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everyone.
Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.